Weaver of Context, Caroline Casey. So in the immortal words of fellow trickster Br'er Rabbit, he says, "There was times when all the creatures used to gather to sagacuate, just like there ain't been no hard times, just like there ain't been no falling out, just like they remembered they were all kin." And so it is. We say medicine abounds. All of nature wants to heal us. Yes, so we know from the teachings of Stella Coyote that the jaunty, enthusiastic resilience for life, the oceans can come back. The thing, if we just, as humans, quit being rude, so rude. And we note now Mars heroism, how a culture defines heroism, and Eros is retrograde, pulling backwards. When a planet representing a quality of intelligence that suffuses creation appears to move backwards, it's really going on a vision quest, going back and in, and we with it. Mars stationed exactly at 12 Cancer on top of the U.S. Sun, so it says, and I'm talking to you, America, especially. You know, so Mars military wants to retreat. And Mars in Cancer says, well, it's going backwards to define heroism as that which protects life rather than that which takes life. So it's the green man. We remember that King Arthur did not die. He goes to Avalon to await the world's call at a time of danger, and we go, now would we good. We know Hi-John the Conqueror from the south, the great trickster. He goes to reside in Hi-John Conqueror Root, again like King Arthur, to await the world's call. We remember from Greek drama that the green room, meaning backstage, was called the green room because it was dedicated to Dionysus, the green man. And as all of us are, in a sense, backstage, we are meditating ourselves into and reclaiming and reconnecting with real heroism, which is the green man. So more than perfectly, Stephen Buhner, and in the last snippets I caught was him saying, I can walk around somebody's house and look at the weeds growing outside and diagnose their illness because the weeds are showing up to heal them. I'm like, ah, I love that. Welcome, Stephen Buhner.
Hi, Caroline. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, it's a great book, The Lost Language of Plants. And then because we know that words are magic, I just wanted to suggest, you know, adding the word recovering, The Lost Language of Plants, to the title. Maybe it's just an invisible word.
Yeah, that's definitely, it's not like it's lost. It's just we quit listening a while back.
Right. So recovering our capacity to listen. But I was so, you know, that's such a useful thing to say when you were speaking in the other show, you know, Ben, about how you can walk around somebody's house and look at the weeds. This is a life-changing thought. You know, and I thought, oh, yes, all the dandelions, of course. I mean, I never kill weeds, but just talking to wonderful board op just now, she said, that's going to make me change my attitude about the weeds. It's like, yes, yes.
I mean, that's one of the things, you know, I suppose in a lot of ways you could say what my work has been about all of these years is about reclaiming the invisible, you know, without bringing that dimension back into our lives. It's very hard to be a human being, and it's extremely hard to be happy. And, you know, there's a lot more to life than mechanicalistic reductionism. And even though a lot of us know that, there's so much focus on that. So when, you know, Henry Thoreau, who is one of my heroes, I love him, and he said, you know, you have to understand nothing is what you've taken it to be. He goes, nothing is what you've taken it to be. And when you go into nature, you have to go unprejudiced. And as he said, to begin to look with the unworn sides of the eye, one of my favorite lines. And so when you do that, and I've worked with plant medicines for 20 years now, and one of the things that you start to see are these amazing, this amazing intelligence and responsiveness and capacity of movement of plants. And, you know, in reading old herbal texts back for over the last 2,000 years, herbalists have always commented on that fact. And everybody knows it. Even the herbalists now that want to be licensed and stuff, they all know about it. They just won't.
Whoops.
What was that?
I don't know. It was master control.
Like some German person.
It was a straight. Whoa! Ooh!
Uh-huh.
Uh-oh. I don't know.
Hello.
Hello. Are we still there? We don't know.
Well, we are. Well, I didn't want to upset all the reductionists. You know, so, I mean, they're cutting us off here.
Master control, the NSA.
But that's one of the things that herbalists have known for thousands of years, that plants have this tremendous power of perception and movement, and that when someone needs a plant medicine, it will begin growing around their home or in that close vicinity. And I've watched this with incredible wonder and awe for 20 years of it happening, and it's such a consistent thing, and yet very few people will talk about it because it just starts to get us away from that reductionistic perspective.
Well, can you tease us with some examples? I know you said that when you walk through Eastern Washington State, the plants showing up are specific.
Oh, yeah, the Eastern Washington State, it's kind of like, I know I'll offend somebody, but it's kind of a miserable place. I didn't really enjoy staying there, but I was kind of on this, you know, sabbatical of learning a kind of the universe's 2x4 sort of experience. And so I was there for about 5 years and learned all kinds of amazing things. But one thing that happened is I would notice all of the plants that were growing there were either antidepressant plants like St. John's wort, or they were plants for damaged livers. And so I figured, God, there's got to be a lot of depressed alcoholics around here. And in fact, there were. So that's one example. Another great one is in Lyme disease. About 6 months to a year before Lyme disease moves into a new location, this plant, Japanese knotweed, which is moving up the East Coast, just preceding the movement of Lyme disease into those areas. And it is, the root of that plant is probably the most specific plant to treat Lyme disease that there is.
Uh-huh, because my dogs, oops, now we have a strange echo, but my dogs are on a Chinese herbal formula for Lyme disease, I guess Japanese knotweed. So it's moving up the East Coast. That's really good to know.
Yeah. And so that kind of thing, it's, you know, there's so many things that were taught growing up that are really untrue, and all of us end up struggling a great deal more than I think we need to with the human predicament. And because so many of the things, you know, Bucky Fuller was really an interesting guy, and he said this thing years ago. He said, you know, if the words that you use to describe reality are inaccurate, every time you use them, it will make you slightly insane. Like the words sunrise and sunset, you see, there's really no such thing. There's sunsight and sun eclipse, but the sun doesn't rise and it doesn't set. So when you learn how to describe what's happening in the universe and the world accurately, you begin to come more in balance and harmony with what's really true there. And one of the things that's really true is nature is not red in tooth and claw like we've been taught. And there is this whole realm of the invisible, this caring capacity for things that's more than the sum of the parts that all of us encounter all of the time. And it's really necessary for our humanity that we encounter it. We're meant to.
And one of the things from the Science New York Times I always use, but it was an article that said scientists discover that beneath every river is an invisible river teeming with microorganisms and all, about 500 feet out, about 500 feet down. And then they said, and we've determined that the health of the visible river depends on the health of the invisible river. And I thought, this is it. This is metaphysics 101. What a good idea. And in that sense, let's just to stir up useful trouble, I was so heartened when you took on page 51 Ken Wilber's work. Can we just stir up useful trouble in that regard?
Oh yeah, sure. This is one I probably like picking on dead white guys a lot, and he's one of the dead white guys I like to pick on. So the thing about Ken Wilber is, you know, he's got this kind of shaming technique that he uses in his writing, which I find he has a lot of great ideas, but this kind of shaming technique is really common amongst reductionists. And for instance, so there's this tremendous poem by a German poet named Norbert Meyer, which I've used for many years in my teaching, and it goes like this. He goes, "Just now a rock took fright when it saw me. It escaped by playing dead." And I love that, you know, and I've used that poem to thousands of different people in many different countries. And when the meaning of the poem penetrates people's bodies, there's this childlike joy and laughter that just spontaneously erupts out of the audience. And there's this kind of feeling in the air, one of the important invisibles of our life, this feeling that happens, and there's this joyful childlikeness, but also it brings back this kind of awareness into the room that everything's really alive and aware that we have always known but have been taught out of. So, you know, then Ken Wilber's got a great response to that. You know, it's a miserable guy's got this response. He goes, contraire, the only thing that you and your pet rock can share together is that you both fall at the same rate.
Yes.
And well, that feeling, to watch what happens in a room when I then share that, and as the meaning of that penetrates people's bodies, that joyfulness leaches away from the room, and what's left is this almost existential emptiness and sadness and kind of, oh yeah, we're just alone on this ball of rock hurtling around the sun, you know, and there's no other intelligent life here, and we're just kind of, you know, yuck. And that's what's sort of left. And it sums up the great existential, or even what, as Gregory Bateson might have said, the epistemological error of our time to accept that there is no other soul force out there, that we are alone. And this is the first time in the history of human habitation of Earth that any culture has ever believed that thing.
Yes, well, here's where we're really kin, because it's a crucial thing to tease out, aside from just, you know, jumping on one particular guy as a symbol, because so often reductionism does masquerade as grown-upness.
It often masquerades as grown-upness, and there's this kind of always, and there's this hidden thing inside of the reductionistic communication, which is, if you don't believe this, there's something wrong with you, you know, and there's a shaming dynamic that's involved. So,
right,
you know, supposedly science is the search for truth without preconception. So if it is truly the search for truth without preconception, there's no reason for a shaming dynamic to be embedded within the communication, no reason for a totalitarian kind of oppression of ideas. There's no reason to be afraid of the idea that there is soul force in other things, that human beings have experienced it and believed it for thousands upon thousands of generations. So why is everybody so nervous?
Yes, and what I like to say is, let the truth of animism eclipse the hubris of humanism. And because what we're going for here in your book, The Lost Language of Plants, as well as your book on sacred plants, as well as all of our hearts and this show, is, you know, what is the medicine in its many forms so that we heal ourselves, heal our capacity to dance with the world that is more than willing to be resilient, so that we don't do this again? You know, what is the kind of root cause? And I think you're pointing out, you know, tyranny, shaming, reductionism, grown-upness, you know, also, I mean, I'm an astrologer, but in these disciplines also that have been exiled, there are people who, even though they're a part of them, they still want daddy to approve of them. So there's a whole movement called psychological astrology. Like, we're grown up because we have, you know, MAs in psychology too, and we're going to have standards and testing, and any use of magic, any of the term magic, will be met with scorn and derisive laughter.
Yeah, that whole thing, you know, I mean, I've been involved with the human potential movement since, 68, I guess. And I worked for many years as a psychotherapist, and then for many years with plants, and just across the whole spectrum with body work and midwifery and all of that dynamic. And there's this thing that I see, and it's very strong in herbal medicine now, that, you know, there's this kind of rational phytotherapy group that wants everybody to be licensed and to go through this kind of what they call a rigorous training, which basically is just a poor man's cousin of medical training. And the weird thing is, like, you know, I don't know anybody that says, I love going to the hospital. I feel so loved there. You know, it is like, it's like a big hug, isn't it? You know, it's like, it's not the way it is. When you walk into a hospital, the predominant feeling is fear. Everybody feels it, but nobody will talk about it. And the thing is, people are in need, and they have a suffering, and they're going to these people to get healed. Shouldn't the predominant feeling that they experience when they go in there is love, our caring, our empathy, our some kind of enfoldment, not fear? And so why is anybody even trying to copy that system? Well, it's because they want to feel like they're grown up. They want to get insurance reimbursement. They want to be considered an equal player. But in doing that, everybody begins to leave behind the essentials that called them to the craft anyway. They begin to lose the invisibles that shape and inform human experience in that area. And I just think it's a ridiculous choice.
Excellent. No, that's right. When astrologers go that way, because it can happen, I say, you know, I could devise a test of what I think you should know to be an astrologer, and you would not pass. And I would never, ever do that. You know, and it's like a bumper sticker that says, if evolution is outlawed, only outlaws will evolve.
I like that one.
Which takes us to one of your great allies, also Walt Whitman. Right?
Yeah, I love Walt Whitman.
Because, you know, when I was using your book also as divination and saying, all right, we want to put many things on the table here, but also how do we not be discouraged when you put out, you know, plants have been communal for 500 million years and they have so much chemical manufacture and things we want to put on the table, and us humans are going, dum, 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 you know. But Whitman says in your book, be not discouraged, keep on, there are divine things well enveloped. I swear to you, there are divine things more beautiful than words can tell. It's like, So he was a great outsider.
Yes, and that stuff is great. It's like, you know, one of the things, there's a sequel to Lost Language of Plants called The Secret Teachings of Plants, and in there I talk about this thing called aesthesis. There's this experience human beings have routinely every day, you know, and we can remember it most easily when we think about puppies. Like, if you see just a little six-week-old puppy walking along the ground, and, you know, the floor, they're sniffing and their tail's wagging like it does, and, you know, their back legs at that age always seem to walk a little faster than their front legs, so they're kind of catty-corner, you know, and it's anybody that sees a puppy like that likes dogs at all, they just can't stand it after all, they go, here, boy, and the puppy looks up at you, and in that moment of recognition, you can feel this thing come from the puppy and go inside your body, and there's a thing that goes from you inside the puppy's body, and that moment of contact is marked by this kind of deep breathing, this breath. You go, oh, and the puppy runs over, and you guys begin touching each other, and there's this kind of sharing that happens. Well, you know, that thing is one of the realest experiences we can know as human beings, but we don't have any word for it in our language now. It took me 27 years to find the word, and the Greeks called it aesthesis. It's the moment when there's the contact between the soul of a human being and the soul from something in the outside world, and the word literally means to breathe in, because they knew that the source of inspiration for human beings was not in us, but in the world around us, and it came from that moment of soul contact and soul exchange, one of the most important invisibles we can ever find. And that thing, that's why I think Václav Havel, who's one of my great heroes, the former president of the Czech Republic, he said, you know, in our time, we can describe our organs, their functions, the cellular dynamics better than any human being has ever been able to do in the history of the planet itself. Yet, it seems that our ancestors knew something more important about being a human being than we do, something which escapes us. And it's that capacity for aesthesis. That's what Walt Whitman was talking about, the divine things well enveloped, that when we go into the world without preconceptions, without assuming that a plant is stupid or a stone is insentient, that we begin to make contact with the intelligence and soul in the world, and we begin to breathe in that different way, and we begin to be inspired. It is impossible not to have hope if you have that experience every day.
Yes, and since, again, what sort of teased me into your book and you being here is that you know, all of nature wants to heal us, the plants are showing up, and so to tease that a little bit, when in astrology we speak of the quality of intelligence known as Uranus, it's the trickster, it's ingenious, it's inventive, it's evolutionary drive, adaptation, now going forward, so if we say, you know, we humans in our hubris have set such forces in motion, you know, that now everything's going to have to change, experiment, adapt, and cooperate faster, Maybe you can guide us into what you see happening in the plant world, how we can better cooperate with the plant world, you know, the trees moving north, there's a lot of things going on. The termites for the first time ever in North Dakota, and you know, going, oh, blah, blah, blah. It's really cooking now, and people, everyone, even the most dunderheaded, you know, among us, go, whoa, weather's funny. You know, I mean, we're really, it's really moving. How do you think about the plants adopting? What?
Well, here's how I think about it. This is basically what I do. I spend and have spent the last 37 years of my life immersing myself in the wildness of the world and trying to learn what it really means to be a human being. What does it really mean to work with plants? And what is nature? What is going on, you know? And the thing is, the one basic bottom line thing that's, you know, kind of left out from all of our talking in the United States these days is the fact that we're all already dead. We died a long time ago. We're just memories in somebody 1,000 years from now, you know? And it's like, we get so caught up in this belief that there's some sort of safety, and that's kind of what the corporations have been selling us. That's what doctors have been selling us. That's why they got licensure. Yeah, we'll make it, you can live forever. And that kind of belief, it runs through the New Age community, the liberal community. It's kind of everywhere. But the thing is, what's really true about nature, there is no such thing as safety. It doesn't exist. And so we've had this kind of period of time since World War II, really, that has been spectacular. It's kind of a historical anomaly, you know, with antibiotics, for instance, is one of the areas. I mean, you know, I've looked at maybe 50 different environmental factors, and they're all kind of reaching this quite nasty peak at the same time. You know, population problems have a horrible way of solving themselves. But so the thing about antibiotics, then, using the antibiotics as much as we have as a people, it put this kind of artificial barrier around us, this island of safety, and the universe doesn't like it. Things are meant to flux and change. So what happens is they are having to use more and more antibiotics to keep that island of safety, even though every epidemiologist in the United States knows it's a fool's errand. It's not going to last. And what we're beginning to see now is the first cracks in the dam. It's like this pressure against a dam, and we're about to move into a period of extremely rapid change, which is going to be discomforting for a lot of us. However, it's mostly uncomfortable and frightening. There's really two reasons. One, because we have some weird illusionary belief that safety is possible. And secondly, that very few people in the United States now know really how to take care of themselves. So that's the kind of that fear is a knee-jerk response. Like, what do things mean? What do I do? I can't even fix my own car, much less my own medicine. So, you know, everybody's feeling this. Nevertheless, at the same time, there's this kind of exchange of communication between the plant world and the human beings, between a lot of the natural world and human beings, that just we don't normally listen. So that dynamic of how plants begin to show up, for instance, where they're needed, see, and it's not really confined to that. You know, it's really intriguing. If you look at epidemiological predictions about antibiotics, they already said we're in the end of the antibiotic era. There's going to be just a tiny amount of time before none of the antibiotics work, and we're going to get epidemic diseases more potent than human beings have ever experienced before. So, yeah, that's really scary. But at the same time, over the last 30 years, all of these people have been training as herbalists. You know, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of them in the United States alone. Nobody knows they're out there. I mean, they're disguised as housewives and postal clerks, you know, gardeners, you know, and car mechanics. And the amazing thing is, when the antibiotics quit working, there's going to be all these herbalists in place that know how to use plant medicines. It's like they're being called on to change. And I've asked thousands of people, like, why did you decide to study plant medicine and become an herbalist? I mean, it's a profession you aren't legally able to practice. And the answer is always some version of, I don't know, I just felt like I should.
Yes. And you know, when I did go to the hospital when my dog was savaged and I got in the middle and whatever, and it was a bleak place and causing those meditations that you're going, oh, this is not even rescue remedies sprayed around the room, for God's sake. But, yes, all that they wanted to do, which I resisted, was, here, take antibiotics, here. And it's like, no, I don't really need those. And you do mention, you know, bacteria are the original ingenious life forces, or they are our ancestors. And you say a new generation, you know, is almost every 20 minutes of bacteria going in. And you also said that for some bacteria, antibiotics are like a pheromone. They love it.
Yeah, they do. I mean, it's like, the thing is, you know, the older I get, the more I realize how little we really know, how little we can ever really know. So it's like we have this tremendous hubris. That's why reductionism is so dangerous, because it gives you the illusion of knowledge and the illusion that you can control this wildness of the world. And what we're really supposed to be doing as human beings is being able to go into the wildness of the world, to walk into it unafraid, to see what's there and to interact with it like our ancestors did thousands of generations ago, and to be able to move with it. I mean, there's so much capacity of the human being to understand that is stunted by us being taught things that are untrue, like that bacteria are dangerous and that we have to have a war on disease and stuff like that. I mean, if bacteria hadn't learned how to become resistant to antibiotics, we would have killed off all life on Earth about 30 years ago, because there is no form of life on Earth except bacteria in infinite combination. So that lack of awareness on our part, I mean, I don't really know what people learn in school, but it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the real world.
Well, and certainly that which we admire in the bacteria that you very much honor is that their learning rate is fantastic. And I think that, you know, we admire, I just want to go back just to moderately quibble, which is that, I mean, life does love safety, and safety is found in symbiosis. I mean, we like safety and we like risk, but, you know, the womb, the courtyard, the container to grow. So it's a legitimate hunger, and then we say that life in its ever wanting safety and risk and safety and risk and safety and risk, then that's also where symbiosis comes in, because you delineate, maybe you can do that, some of the really fun stuff for us now, but, you know, the plants that will create with their relationship to the mycelia and the fungi, and if they're being attacked by a particular kind of spider mite, they will analyze the saliva and manufacture something which either attracts the predator of that particular pest, or will, this is also really cool, or will create a chemical that smells like the alarm for that guy, for that particular, going, oh,
yeah,
we've got to run.
You realize that plants can create hundreds and hundreds of thousands of different chemical structures, and they make them in extremely discrete amounts. I mean, they're many plant chemicals are most active at somewhere between one part per trillion and one part per million. So it's extremely tiny amounts that they're producing that produce tremendous changes at the macro level. So, you know, I mean, one of my favorite stories about that is a researcher who noticed women that live together tend to menstruate at the same time. So he took some of his girlfriend's sweat and diluted it one part per million, and then he went around town to different women and he, you know, just took a Q-tip and dabbed some of that solution on their lip, and after 2 months they're all menstruating together. So you have to realize this thing that was already diluted in her sweat was then diluted again. And what that was able to change the entire physiological functioning of a woman at this macro level. And plants do the exact same thing. They make and release these tiny amounts of chemicals that have profound ecosystem impacts on either individual species or on ecosystems themselves. You know, one of the things that I talk about that you mentioned is their capacity to, they can analyze the saliva in any animal that's feeding on them and determine exactly what that animal is, or insect or whatever it is, and then they can begin, if they wish to make a chemical agent that can interfere with that other organism
functioning. We're going to take a very short break right now, but I want you, while we're doing that, to ruminate on this, because you also mentioned the plant will only begin to do that after the predator's been eating for over 2 hours. It says that going, you can eat some of me, but that's enough. Our guest today is Stephen Buhner. His one of his many books is called The Lost Language of Plants. You can join us after break by calling 510-848-4425, and we will be right back.
She shook the constellation and dazzled them crosses eyes. She shook the constellation and dazzled them crosses eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Let's get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make his voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our honored guest today is Stephen Buhner. One of his latest books is called The Lost Language of Plants, and the book itself is Good Medicine. And again, you can call us if you're inadvertently patient by calling 510-848-4425. So much, again, in your book that is full of, like, let's tease it into implications. So if plants notice when they're being overforaged and they manufacture a chemical that is toxic to the animal so it doesn't eat more, and many other great examples that you might want to bring up, what do you think the plants are doing about us now? That's why I like the plants getting together going, we either have to kill these humans or heal them, because otherwise we're all going down. So what do you think the plants are doing to defend themselves against bad, rude human behavior?
Oh, well, one of the things that they're doing, I mean, it's very common. Plants are, we were having a tiny quibble over the safety issue a little while ago, and I tend to think of it that there's no such thing as safety, but that all organisms have an evolutionary drive to maintain structural stability, which we tend to confuse as safety, and plants are extremely clear about that. They actually tend to grow better. It depends on the species, but anywhere from 15 to a 25% foraging rate actually helps them grow better. So they like that kind of giving. They're really the most giving of life forms. But what happens if then it kind of goes over that amount? They begin doing something to respond to that. And one of the common things that they do is that they begin to affect the reproductive health of whatever organism is feeding on them in an attempt to lower population levels to a more sustainable level. So, for instance, in Australia, they lose about 1 million lambs a year to this clover plants that the sheep feed on, because there's so many estrogenic chemicals in it that it causes miscarriages in the ewes. But that clover there, it only has that level of estrogen in Australia or whenever it's being overfed upon. So you can see that same kind of dynamic happening in the human population, not only with estrogen mimics that are affecting our reproductive systems, but plants as well do the same thing.
Yeah, and actually this whole chapter's on the pharmaceuticals we're dumping in your book, Lost Language of Plants, and also that the shrimp are on Prozac.
They give a lot of the cetacea, the shellfish, they give them Prozac, SSRIs, because it helps stimulate reproduction and stuff like that. I mean, it's what most people don't realize is that very few pharmaceuticals are biodegradable. Once they end up in the environment, they tend to be just as active 20 years from now as they were when they went in. And they, because all life is based on bacterial, our four bacterial progenitors, those things affect every other life form on the planet. So, you know, these chemicals are ubiquitous and they have tremendous impacts everywhere.
But I was amazed. I mean, there's many reasons to not eat shrimp, and I guess shrimp are really, you know, we mustn't do it because harvested in the wild, it kills everything due to practices and farming and Dana. But I hadn't heard the additional reason to not eat shrimp because the poor shrimp are on Prozac. Oh, Lordy. Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, chemotherapy and how that goes into the every yeah, and that is, you know, how we heal ourselves. That's a crucial point that you're making. The chemotherapy, of course, is this huge toxin to not only medical practitioners, but then on out into the environment. And do we really want to heal ourselves with something that poisons the world?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Why do we want another 3 years of life or 18 months or 6 months? At the end, that there's this kind of frantic dynamic about it. You know, I think it's very uncommon now to meet people who are actually living their own life, but it's even rarer to meet people that are living their own death. And living your death is an incredibly important thing. I mean, now we're just passive spectators. I mean, the cancer's killing us, and we just are sitting in the wheelchair watching it happen. But once upon a time, the death that came to each human being was individual, meant for them, a teaching of the soul like everything else. And you immersed yourself in it, and you lived your dying, and that is the thing. I mean, that is so far out of our awareness anymore. I mean, we're not going to be able to avoid it. We might as well get something out of it.
That's good. Well, let's go to our first inadvertently patient caller, Larry in Newark. Come in.
Yes. Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi. Yeah. Let me just throw out a few things real quick here. First of all, I love the way your guest channels Terrence McKenna in his voice intonation. It's really amusing. I wanted to recommend a author who seems to be a science fiction author that seems to be very much on the same wavelength as what you're talking about today, is a fellow named Greg Bear. He has a book called Vitals, which is basically a conspiracy theory book about how bacteria actually run the earth. And he also has a book called Darwin's Radio, about what our genes do, all that so-called junk DNA, what our DNA is doing when we're not watching it. But the point I wanted to get to here was about reductionism. I find these reductionist kind of ways of looking at the world to be alarmingly popular in the visionary and New Age community. And a lot of the people I talk to that seem, you know, in other ways to be very on top of it and engaged and so on, seem to be very attracted to people like Zachariah Sitchin. And Sitchin stuff, as far as I could tell, I could get some other people too, but Sitchin stuff, as far as I could tell, reduces all of human history, all of human endeavor, all of religion, science, and whatever, to a failed lab experiment, and not even an interesting lab experiment where the results are still in question, but one that he describes in dreary detail, even to the name of the person that dropped the metaphoric test tube or whatever. In other words, he even though these things happened umpteen thousand years ago, he claims he knows the names of everyone involved,
and that's enough. that's good, because we don't. Yeah, we know that certainty is a booby prize, and we do. We absolutely, those who know are lost. It's in that spirit. Absolutely, there's a place for irony. I mean, I do like Kurt Vonnegut saying that all of human history is just one alien civilization saying hi to another. Hello. So there's humor and. Yeah, Zachariah Sitchin, there's many people in there, but point well taken. We go, yes, we are not reducing, we're distilling, we're brewing, whatever its guise of reductionism or tyranny or certainty, we go, no, certainty is always wondering. And I think that's what you were saying, a very strong, great thing you were saying, Stephen Buhner, about death. 'Cause, so your impulse would be, you know, to not subject yourself to the certainty of others in these mysterious life things so that you don't go get tests in hospitals? You would not, you know, turn yourself into the authorities?
Oh, I might get. I will occasionally ask if a medical physician for a diagnosis if there's something I'm struggling with I'm not clear about. But it's extremely rare for me to seek any treatment in that arena. You know, I got involved in plant medicine like a lot of people do because I was really ill and the doctors didn't know what was wrong with me. So 20 years ago, and it turned out there was a plant growing in my front yard that healed me. And so I became kind of a born again, I ate the wild redeemer. And once that happens, you know, nothing is ever the same again.
So what was that plant?
Oh, it was a plant called OSHA.
Yes.
Quite a wonderful plant, and it was
bear medicine.
They're very much bear medicine, and so that kind of, it's this amazing thing that happens when you eat the wild redeemer. When you know, the people that I meet at herbal conferences, most of them who go to them do so because once upon a time a plant saved their life and this invisible thing came into their life. And it begins to change everything because you have this feeling, that not just a feeling, an experience of being saved by the wildness of the world. And everything changes then. The entire perspective is different, and it opens a doorway into the wildness of the world, into the intelligence and soulfulness of the world that I think is very difficult to find. You know, we happen on it now by accident, mostly, because it's not incorporated into the mythology of our culture. And it's like you mentioned earlier this evening when we were talking about how if we have a vacuum in our mythology, then toxic myths come in. And that happens a great deal here. We have almost like a monocropping of the spiritual with our, you know, the spirituality being limited to Christianity as a dominant form, for instance, our mechanicalistic reductionism in science. There's these great monoliths of monocropping behavior and thinking and in spirituality. And so there's this vacuum in which toxic myths can come into us. And so somehow we find the real mythology that's still alive by accident, I think, most of us now.
Well, I think that's the weeds outside our homes volunteering, you know, will we find the thing that heals us before we kill it is a large, you know, kind of theme. We wonder now, and I love the idea of you looking down, and maybe you could also just tell us some of the marvels of OSHA root as bear medicine, what the bears do with it.
No, well, it's an astonishing plant, and what's really interesting, and is in almost every language, in ancient indigenous language where they talk about that plant, and has its name as some version of, you know, bear medicine. And the bears are interesting. When they come out in the spring, the male bear will often dig up OSHA, and they chew it up into kind of this like a watery paste. And then when the female comes out, he'll spray it over her body and wash her body with it. They'll wash their faces, their hands, and it kind of gets rid of these parasites that get on them during the long winter hibernation. They'll eat a bunch of it, and it kind of cleans out their intestinal system. But it's more, to me, it's even, the root actually is very hairy. It looks like a black bear in its shape, its color, its texture. And it's got that kind of, to me, the wisdom of the looks within place, which is one of the great teachings of the bear, the ability to go into the dark and be unafraid, to go into the looks within place. And it's got a kind of a warrior dynamic to it. It really strengthens the spirit. I mean, in terms of just straight pharmacological actions, I mean, it's a wonderful antiviral, a wonderful antibacterial, it's antiparasitic, and a great many things like that, and it also has a wonderful taste to it. But in this more, the invisible dimensions of the plant, it really brings in this kind of capacity with people who have difficulty walking into the dark and being unafraid. And that's one of the major indicators that I have for its use.
And oh, that's great. It's also got that wonderful smoky taste.
It does. It's indescribably. The umbelliferae family are actually remarkable, and they're a number of my favorite plants.
That's great. And then also I was amused to read that chicory produces antifungal compounds. And I thought, chicory? Where do we eat chicory in this country? In New Orleans. And I go, oh, well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of need for antifungal compounds there. That's good. Let's go to our next caller, who is Lisa in Oakland. Come in.
Hi. Excuse me. I wanted to just admire and appreciate you both for I'm a colon hydrotherapist who works in Berkeley, and I live and teach the probiotic life, and I think it's so excellent to recognize the bacteriological aspect and how we're, well, how it's been with us all our lives, and we're not a part of it anymore. We're kind of detached from it. And I just recently found the probiotic lifestyle, and I wanted to just admire you both, because I feel like the talk that I'm hearing from you both right now is, it's really, really familiar, and it's part of helping me to remember my future. Sort of like my childhood memory of right now, because I have this strong urge to go out into the wilderness and to go back to nature. And what you're telling me, it's like an affirmation, because it's a self-preserving thing that I'm feeling, to go back and farm, and it's something you have to plod your way out of, to get out of the cities, to get out of this lifestyle, and I'm doing it. And it's something that I knew I was going to do when I was little. And I keep seeing signs everywhere that I'm going in the right direction. And I just want to thank
you
for this. Yeah?
You're welcome. And also, how do you think of a probiotic lifestyle?
I see it as eating a lot of the Mediterranean diet, keeping really, really probiotic diet. A lot of yogurt, live cultured vegetables, kombucha, kimchi. I know that they I read an article that they were healing the chickens in China with kimchi. The chickens that had that avian bird flu or the probiotics is where it's at nowadays.
Yeah, that's great. Let me let Stephen respond with probiotics. But yes, on into the wild, Lisa. Great.
It's eating in more harmony with that stuff. You know, it's like I wrote this book on ancient fermentation and beer making. And, you know, it's like we all think, oh, the white man brought, alcohol to the Indians. Well, it turns out almost every indigenous tribe on the face of the earth has always made alcohol and enjoyed the heck of it, just like birds and bees and everything else. I mean, elephants.
Elephants, yes.
They even make beer themselves. I mean, they knock over palm trees and they step on the trunks and create a depression, and the sap fills up in the hole, and then it slowly ferments, and then they sway in the jungle waiting until it's ready and they drink it.
So it's a
ubiquitous kind of experience for human beings. And one of the really interesting things to do is to get a bunch of live beers, because beer is a fermented food. And if you get live beers, which will be bottle conditioned is what it'll say, or fermented in the bottle, carbonated in the bottle, and then drink a bunch of those, and then drink some dead beers like Budweiser or stuff like that. It's absolutely an amazing experience to feel the difference in vitality of the food. It's really astonishing. Plus, you get kind of high, too, which is also nice.
That's great. So remind us again, what does it say on the bottle? That if it's
bottle conditioned.
Bottle conditioned. Okay. So you like Lisa's recommendations of yogurt, kombucha, kimchi, fermented things, sauerkraut.
I love kimchi. You know, I'm not a big kombucha freak. It's like it tastes terrible, and I just can't go there. I mean, it may be good for me. There's lots of stuff that's good for me, but I intend on having fun in the process, you know, so I can't do that. But, yeah, kimchi is great. Sauerkraut's great. I mean, there's a lot of really great fermented foods.
Absolutely. That's great. Let's go to Deborah in Nevada City.
Hello.
I
love all the things you've said, because as a child I knew that the invisible world was where everything came from. But anyway, and I have had chemotherapy and radiation, and I'm living now 10 years, 12 years, some amount of time later. And it was a horrible experience. I think I drained every really calcium piece or any kind of that stuff out. But I supplement every day. And I also wanted to mention that Dr. Eboli, professor of philosophy and politics, and his website is spotlightonfreedom.com, has told me about this domestic terrorism thing that has come and actually been voted on, or going to be voted on even more. So we all need to call our senators and congressmen and get them to stop this, because this this act will...
Oh, yeah, I was reading about that today. It's
from,
like...
protesting.
It's like if you even think bad thoughts, you can get arrested,
yeah.
Kind of a bill.
And if you have dying, you know, you're all, you know, in trouble. And they won't allow internet... protests of any kind, you know, it's just all wrong.
You know, and I think bad thoughts all of the time, so I'm definitely
anyway, the
going
name
to be
of
in
the
trouble.
Bill, number of the bill is H.R. 19955, and
that's good. Thank you, Deborah. That's a good thing to bring up. It's true. It's also like the firemen are being instructed to look for any evidence of discontent with America when they're putting out your fire in your house.
Right.
And you go, oh, discontent is more American than apple pie. Yeah, so there is that. And I think, you know, part of what I was learning from nature and Stella Coyote and everything also is we want to have respect for danger, but not fear. So we do want to call our Senate people and go, no, this homegrown terrorism act, it's a crime against language, too, for those who've read it. I mean, it's like appalling language. God, who's your editor? You know, it's just ridiculous blather and committees and funding and you know, dark innuendos, but extremely badly written. So we do want to go, no. But we don't want to go, oh, no. But yes, absolutely, Deborah, we will call, and we'll get the plants right on this, too. The plants are arranging everything. So what would the plants say about this bill? How do you respond to...
The thing is, my perspective now on everything, I have one primary question I always ask. What's the ecological function?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the question that nobody's asked about the human species, which is the only important question, is what is the ecological function of the human species? Okay. It's like no... form of life is expressed out of the ecological matrix of this planet without a specific ecological function. Otherwise, it wouldn't evolve. It wouldn't emerge.
I have a quip answer, but I bet you have a better one.
So that's the question. It's like everybody's struggling with, you know, we're like overpopulating the planet. We're doing all of this stuff. And some people see the human species as a virus or a cancer or a plague. And definitely there's a great grief and sadness in it when we see old growth forests. I mean, the feeling of an old growth forest being cut down is one of the most difficult things to endure that I have experienced. So what do we do with those feelings? But one of the most important things to ask is, you know, I mean, what is the ecological function of the human species? What is the ecological function of George Bush? So then we start to understand what is it that Gaia is involved in with us before we make a decision. Like I was talking about Japanese knotweed, and people on the East Coast of the United States see it as an invasive botanical, and they try to root it out and get rid of it without realizing what it's doing there, the important thing that it's fulfilling, and that part of which is the treatment of Lyme disease. So when we try to approach the problem of the human species, and this bill is just a minor part of this area that we're dealing with now anyway, because all of us know something is wrong. Something is wrong, and we need to do something. We just don't know what to do. So the first thing is to ask the right question. And once you get the right question, then the answers themselves that you find, those determine right action, right livelihood that automatically come out of it.
So,
well, see, Bucky Fuller said a long time ago, I thought it was a metaphor, he said, we're like bees, you see. Bees who go out looking for honey without realizing that we're also performing cross-pollination. And the thing is that, you know, Richard Dawkins, who I really hate, Mr. Mechanicalistic Reductionist of himself, you know, he said, well, to Jim Lovelock, well, Gaia isn't, you know, a living organism because Gaia doesn't reproduce. And I went, oh, how do you know? Gaia's 3.5 billion years old and you're 62, so how would you even know? But nevertheless, when you look at our spaceships that are going out into space, we're basically pollinators for the planet, and where you're taking the bacteria that are the germinators of all life on this planet to every other place in the solar system, to planets in other solar systems. And what's fascinating is when you look at our space vehicles, they look exactly, and I don't mean sort of alike, they look exactly like viruses. And so we have
viruses look like little penises, basically?
They look like little spaceships, like the Mars lander and stuff. There's viruses that look exactly like that.
So we're back to Larry's recommendation. Larry in Newark, recommending Greg Bear and the bacteria running.
Well, Greg Bear's a little bit mechanicalistic for me, you know, so I don't really go with his stuff.
Right.
I'm kind of more of a Roger Zelazny kind of guy.
Yeah, so the spores, that's got, well, I mean, I like saying, you know, what is the purpose of humans actually? It's to give pleasure to animals, because we have these hands, we can tickle them, and they really like it.
Since we're animals and we can give pleasure to ourselves, it's perfect all the way around.
That's right, so that's the only answer I've been able to come up with exactly. Let's go to James from Oakland. I think we have a few minutes.
Yeah. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. Well, my question is, what sort of plants grow around us when many of us have colds during the cold season? And how can we benefit from, you know,
Useful.
There's a lot of different plants that grow around people that are good for things like that, and it just depends on how you approach it. Like, you know, actually, my great-grandparents grew up eating dandelion greens all of the time, and part of the thing, and nettles and a whole lot of other things. So one of the things that happens is there's a lot of plants that grow around people's houses that are actually nourishing foods that help maintain and nourish the immune system and keep us healthy, like red clover, dandelions, nettles, and a lot of stuff like that. And then there's always more specific, stronger plants that are real specific for kind of acute conditions like that. And so one of the major ones for colds and kind of that general bronchial kind of problem that I use is the evergreen trees, pines and junipers and stuff like that. Since you're in California, I would expect there's probably eucalyptus trees every place around you, because I remember living in San Francisco, they were everywhere, and that's probably one of the most specific plants for upper respiratory infection.
And what do you do with the pines and juniper?
Oh, well, the pines and juniper, well, the eucalyptus, you would take the leaves, and you can do the same thing with the pine and juniper. You can, well, actually, if you drink pine tea, pine needle tea is extremely high in vitamin C and a number of other things. And also, if you boil it and then you breathe it in, the vapors, really, it helps open up the breathing channels in the lung tissue, and also it's very, very antibacterial.
And the eucalyptus, of course, is an invasive species.
It's an invasive species.
So did it arrive going, all right, they think they're taking me, but I know they're going to need them.
Yeah, and it's an absolutely remarkable plant. Eucalyptus is actually effective against many of the common antibiotic-resistant bacteria as well.
By making a tea,
yes, and a very strong, what would more properly be called an infusion, which is an extremely strong tea, yes.
And then there's prickly pear where you live.
And prickly pear is one of my favorite plants. I mean, you know, we're out here with all kinds of scorpions and rattlesnakes and everything else. And one of the neat things is if you get bit by one of those, if you take a prickly pear pad and fillet it and then put that on the wound, it's probably one of the best ways to treat it. It draws out the poison quite nicely.
And you said it's mildly psychotropic.
It is mildly psychotropic. You actually listened to that show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the thing about prickly pear, yeah, it's like you take it and you fillet it and then you puree it and drink it. And it's one of the most refreshingly potent kind of things to drink as a wild plant food. But also it's mildly psychotropic when you do that. It really does change awareness. See, all plants to me are sacred. All plants are psychotropic. They all change awareness. It's just that some of them, we're so thick-headed, some of them have to beat us over the head before we notice it. But once you begin to notice, you notice the subtle alterations of all of them. And prickly pear is quite nice that way.
That's wonderful. All plants are medicine. All life is medicine. Thank you for your book, which is medicine. Thank you for being Medicine Man, Stephen Buhner. And